This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franson, are your hosts for today. Hello, Gina. We have a lot of events to report from last weekend and lots about agriculture, so I'm glad you're on hand as our farm reporter.
Hello, Susan. Well, but before we get to the farm, I know you took a road trip without me last Saturday.
Yes, I did. It was such a beautiful day that I wanted to catch a festival. You know, we always try to cover them in advance. Then we can give them a little promotion. But last weekend, I noticed it was Old Settlers Day in Maxwell. And that was already taking place. I've never been to Maxwell before, and I couldn't get hold of you at the last minute. So I just took off with Fritz for a few hours on Saturday morning.
Did you know that Maxwell just won the state softball championship for the second year in a row?
Yes, I've been reading about that even on the front page of local papers in the area. That was one of the reasons I thought I'd like to visit Maxwell.
And so what did you find there?
When we drove into town, all the streets around Main Street were packed with cars. I was really glad Fritz could drop me off near the beginning of the parade route because it would have been a long walk if I'd had to park. Maybe that explains why Main Street was already packed when I arrived 15 minutes before the parade was due to start. And the MC was busy entertaining the crowd by inviting kids up to the mic to tell jokes in exchange for candy and ice cream cones. His location was in front of the museum and next door to the library, which was open. I went in to see if I could find out something about the town. Here's what Beanne Sandy told me. So tell me a little bit about living here in Maxwell. What is it like?
Well, it's a nice community. Everybody knows everyone. So a lot of, like I said, a lot of town spirit, a lot of history behind the town. Old Settlers, they take it pretty seriously. So they put a lot of work into making sure there's something for everybody. So
yeah.
And the museum is so neat. You'll really enjoy it, I think. And they have a nice group that takes care of it, and they, you know, frequently change things up over there. So, Yeah, it's really neat.
When I left the library, the parade was starting, so I walked down the street a block past the MC to get a better vantage point. It was fun to record the MC's chatter, but I'll just play the beginning.
It kicks off the parade for Maxwell 2019. Hey, you know what? Football's right around the corner, too. I don't know where the Spartans are at. But when they get here, we'll chit-chat with them, see how our football program's looking, because our softball is looking fantastic. The Collins Maxwell Spartans marching band. Play a tune. Let's hear something. Slow down. Stop right here. Let's make some noise right here. Collins Maxwell Spartans Marching Band! Colleen Patterson, Swalwa, daughter of Charlie Ann Patterson, congratulations to the Grand Marshal Colleen Swalwell. Here we go. Tom and Susan have spent most of their lives together. Maxwell, Tom went through school to Maxwell. Sue went through in Collins Maxwell School for 35 years. They are thankful for many blessings, for the love and grace of God, and for the love and support of the Collins Maxwell community. That's the King and Queen, Tom and Sue Lee. The Prince and Princess, Hayden, is the son of Jerry and Heather. Hayden loves stuffed animals, hot dogs, and superheroes. In his free time, Hayden enjoys going to the pool, riding bikes, reading, doing all kinds of cool and fun stuff. Anne Marie is the daughter of Mark, and Anne Marie enjoys taekwondo. Ooh, be careful there, young lad. She's a taekwondo girl, tumbling, and wants to be a superhero when she grows up. The princess and prince for the parade. Now, the Maxwell Fire Department, Tony heads it up as far as I know he still does. If you've got a fire, he'll come out and watch it. Get a chance. No, that's wrong. Don't get a chance. Tony Ness will cover your fire with a great group of guys.
Without visuals, I'm not sure my soundtrack makes much sense, so I'll just give my impressions. What came next were the fire trucks, not only from Maxwell, but from volunteer fire departments in Elkhart, Cambridge, and Collins. As the MC said, we'd better not have a fire now because all the good stuff is right here. This was also a way of honoring the volunteer firemen, as well as the first responders. There were many restored vintage cars and tractors, and a diesel tractor and trucks representing local businesses. The entire reunion class of 1969 was on a float. I didn't count them, but I think there must have been about 20, which is pretty good for a 50th class reunion. But the real hit was the wrapped candies that were thrown out by the handfuls from every vehicle. Paul Wearson tells me that this is an essential element in every small-town parade. But I was impressed by the obvious local pride. Maxwell has a prosperous-looking main street with many of the anchor institutions Paul and I talk about, besides an elementary, middle, and high school from the Collins-Maxwell district. It has a library, historical society, post office, bank, and more that you'll hear about when we go to the museum. Incidentally, the museum is located in two buildings on two separate blocks. I ducked into the south building just as the parade was winding down and immediately met the man I wanted to interview.
I'm Jerry White. I'm the president of the museum here. Museum has got our charter in 1964. Maxwell wasn't one of the first towns out here. Iowa Center and Peoria City were the two close towns. When they were bringing the railroad through, it was supposed to go through Iowa Center. And at one time, they had rumored that it would be the state capital. And then when they got surveying for the railroad to Iowa Center, they found, and you go just west of Iowa Center, you drop down on Skunk River Bottom. And it was nothing but a bog, you know. So they decided they had to move south. So they came 3 miles south because through this area, they had an abundance of sand to make road grade and water very abundant here in Maxwell. So then they started the railroad here. Well, as soon as the railroad came through here, the people from Peoria City and Iowa Center, stores and everything, was migrated right here to Maxwell. And this museum, it's not a Maxwell museum. It's a community museum. When they organized, we have information from Iowa Center, from Cambridge, and of course from Maxwell, Melkart, Loring, Peoria City. People that worked in this museum were all from this surrounding area here.
The most impressive thing to me, just walking in the door, was your staircase.
The staircase was from the old Story County courthouse. They've been demolishing it. We got a lot of panels. We got panels from the jury room, and we got the benches from the jury area.
Then I walked up a block to the second building, which was housed in the former three-story furniture store.
This has been here for over 50 years, our museum, and we have three buildings and several floors.
Yeah. So could you tell me again what you have here, the old settlers and so forth?
Former residents of Maxwell area, and some are around the area. And then we also have pictures of what the main street used to look like, different houses.
And you still have a pretty respectable main street.
Yes, we do. Still looks really good. I think everybody tries to keep their buildings up. And
you have a medical center, and what else do you have?
A medical center, grocery store, we got a flower shop, we have a locker, and we have an implement store, and we also have a chiropractor and massage therapist to share a building. So we have a real nice community center that's rented out. We had the school reunion there, the Maxwell School reunion last night there, and a lot of people rent it for receptions and birthdays and things. And the third Sunday of every month, they have a breakfast there, a fundraiser. They let them rent it out for different organizations to make money. The museum does at least once a year. And so it's pretty active. And then the Legion Hall across the street, they rent theirs out for different things, too. And they had a breakfast this morning. Them and the VFW share dinners in the wintertime. They have dinners once a month at the VFW Hall in the evening. We got a really nice library, and it's right next to City Hall. Yeah, and they've revised that, and it's really nice. They have lots and lots of movies, and they get all the latest books. If you want a book, they can get one from, they can call up another library and get it for you in a day. And so, yeah, we did have PALS up here on the corner of the street. It was a restaurant bar thing, and they just sold that, and they're going to redo that, hopefully open it up by the end of this month, so that there'll be an eating place in town. But our grocery store, who does sell sandwiches and stuff, you can get sandwiches there or at Casey's. We're real fortunate, I think, for a small town, for all we have. And I love the museum. Of course, I work here all the time, and so I think we're real fortunate that we have all we have here in the museum.
So are the two museums connected at all?
They're just down the street from it. It's the same organization. We just own three different buildings that we maintain.
How many volunteers? Do you have any idea?
I would say maybe 12 right now. That's maybe stretching it a little bit.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And what's your name?
Pat Smith.
There's a time in each year that we always hold dear, good old summertime, with the birds in the trees and sweet-scented breezes, good old summertime. When your day's work is over, then you are in clover, and life is one beautiful time. No trouble annoying, each one is enjoying the good old summertime. In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lanes with my baby mine. You hold her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very good sign, a sign that she's your Tootsie Wootsie in the good old summertime. In the good old summertime.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And I've been reporting on a road trip I took last Saturday to Maxwell for Old Settlers Days. I haven't done justice to this three-day festival, which included carnival rides, a sanctioned rodeo, truck and tractor pulls, volleyball, slow-pitch softball, tug-of-war, live music from local bands, good eats and drinks all weekends, and a higher-power church service in the park bandstand on Sunday morning. Moving on, we have more summer activities, and there's no more traditional one than the Iowa State Fair, which is kicking off tonight with a parade at the Iowa State Capitol. A two-hour parade that starts at 6 p.m. and will be broadcast live on IPTV starting at 6:15. I haven't checked, but I don't think they'll be throwing candy.
Well, you sure won't get any if you're watching it on TV or live streaming it on Facebook.
Well, if it's food you want or live music up close, join us at KHOI's 7th birthday party next Sunday, August 11th, in the parking lot behind the Ames Historical Society, 4 to 7 p.m. For music, we'll have the Beatles tribute band Rocky Raccoon, the best in Iowa. If you heard them on a Pantorium session a couple of months ago, you'll know how good they are. But I can vouch that live is much better. You probably won't be able to keep from dancing.
Okay, and how about the food? Is there going to be food?
Oh, you bet. We'll have birthday cake, of course, and strawberry fields forever to dip in a chocolate fountain. And if you want something more substantial, the food truck Burgers on the Fly will be on hand. They provided food during our very successful art walk earlier.
Is everybody invited this Sunday?
Of course, but especially our listeners. I'd love to welcome some of our out-of-town listeners, especially from Maxwell, if you're listening. If any of you are there, please come and introduce yourselves to me. I'll be cutting the birthday cake, and I'll be wearing a black KHOI T-shirt. A little birthday music?
For anybody in the audience who's got a birthday today, happy birthday to you!
Do yeah.
I hope you knew that was not Rocky Raccoon. That was the real Beatles and their birthday song. And I just couldn't resist playing that. Now we're moving on to something more serious. Someone emailed me a story on climate science and asked if I could cover it. We like to respond to our listeners' requests, but this didn't sound like a local story. Let me read the first two paragraphs of the article before I tell you or show you how local the story is. One of the nation's leading climate change scientists is quitting the agriculture department in protest over the Trump administration's efforts to bury his groundbreaking study about how rice is losing nutrients because of rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Louis Ziska, a 62-year-old plant physiologist who's worked at the USDA's Agricultural Research Service for more than two decades, told Politico he was alarmed when department officials not only questioned the findings of the study, which raised serious concerns for the 600 million people who depend on rice for most of their calories, but also tried to minimize media coverage of the paper, which was published in the journal Science Advances last year. Well, we don't grow any rice in Iowa, but I know of at least one local scientist who is concerned with exactly the issues in this article, how climate change and soil quality are affecting the nutrition of the food we grow in Iowa. That's Jerry Hatfield, director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment, a facility of the USDA Agricultural Research Service located on the ISU campus. Here's what he told me.
If we look at the impact of CO2 on plants, we know that increasing CO2 levels does increase the size of the plant. They grow bigger. You know, plants like soybeans, wheat, vegetables, respond very positively to the CO2. Plants like corn don't show as much response to CO2 levels because they have a different internal metabolism, but nevertheless, they still show a slight positive. If we take a look at impact of CO2, not only on plant development, but on the quality of whether it be a fruit, a nut, a grain, or forage coming out of that, there is some evidence coming out that CO2 levels are decreasing the quality of the product. One of the first groups to notice this and suggest this was the Australians, who found that over time there was a declining protein content in wheat associated with the rising CO2 levels. We have a sister laboratory working in Colorado on native prairie, exposing plants to current CO2 levels and then CO2 levels that would be anticipated by, say, 2070, 2080, somewhere in that time frame. Found out that these rising CO2 levels decreased the protein content of that forage. Well, they went on to discover and elucidate the fact that when these plants are exposed to high CO2 levels, they do grow faster, they grow bigger, but they outgrow their ability to extract nutrients from the soil. And if we look at this, it really stands to reason that we create an imbalance between carbon and the nutrient supply. And we know that the nutrient supply is critical to the development of all the essential things that we want related to nutrition. A lot of this is our micronutrients that are in there. It's not just nitrogen that's being taken up, but things like sulfur and calcium, potassium, all those different things that get taken up. And so we find that this imbalance is even a little bit more complex, because now we look at rising CO2 levels, we look at the nutrient supply coming from the soil into that plant. We know that that's mediated by soil water in terms of precipitation that's falling. So when we start looking at changing the nutritional quality, it is a result of a lot of different things that occur during the life cycle of that plant. Rising CO2 levels are one part of that. The quality of the soil in terms of its ability to supply those nutrients and water is another critical part of that. It's also depend upon what plant species we have out there. So in the bottom line is that, yes, we do have a changing nutritional quality in all of our plants, but we also need to realize that CO2 is only one factor in terms of changing that nutritional quality.
In connection with the rice study, because it's much more complex than that. Yeah.
You always have to look at it, you know, some of the original things, Susan, I mean, the IPC, you know, in the first Forza report says, you know, there's not going to be a problem with climate change relative to agriculture because rising CO2 is always positive in plants. And yes, that is. But it's only one part of the whole thing that makes plants grow. You got a temperature impact, you got water impacts, you got all these other things we also know are changing. So we live in a complex.
Thank you. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just been talking to Jerry Hatfield about the complex issues that affect the food we grow. This is a concern of KHOI. Several weeks ago, we talked to Jackie Comito from the Iowa Learning Farms and Michelle Young, who was here from the Australian National University, to look at how trees in fields or near them affect the water retention and other qualities of the soil. And as I was leaving Maxwell last Saturday, I just happened to pass a field day that's done by the Practical Farmers of Iowa on agroforestry. And I thought that would be a really great follow-up story. And I noticed that our friend Luke Grand was one of the presenters. And so I called him, and I think he's on the phone with us today. Is he?
Yes.
Luke? Okay, great to talk with you. I'll just turn you over to Gina McAndrews, whom I think you know.
Hello, Luke.
Gina, great to hear your voice.
Can you tell us a little bit about Prudentera and your business and what you do?
Yeah, I'd love to. For about 10 years, I've run my own company based out of Nevada, serving landowners and farmers in Iowa who want to grow more prairie, forest, or wetlands on their farmland or their recreational land. I've got a few recreational landowners that, you know, own like 80 acres and they want to plant 20 acres of trees. So I've gotten an opportunity to really dig into these issues that you've been talking about and focusing on kind of the demand side for these changes, these practices. And what's really fun about our company is we're a design and build firm. So we really are with the landowner each step in the process. We identify prospects, we convert them to a customer. You know, we design an estimate to do a transformation, whether it's seeding prairie or planting trees or reconstructing a wetland. It's a really fun job. I love what I do. And we've got a staff of two part-time and two full-time staff in addition to me. So it's a lot of fun to travel to Iowa. And
sounds like you're keeping busy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about the PFI field day down at Bruce Carney's?
Absolutely, yeah. So every once in a while, I'm invited by my customers to share what we're doing on their land. And the most recent opportunity was with Bruce. Bruce is a really incredible person who's a friend and a customer of mine. And I've learned so much from Bruce, and I've also gotten to share a lot of my knowledge with Bruce. This last weekend, I got to share with about 50 or 60 people how trees work, you know, how to plant trees correctly. You know, tree planting is a game of inches, and so it was really powerful to get to go look at a tree planting with a lot of people that want to plant trees or have planted trees but maybe don't know a lot about how to do it well. So we got dirty right along the ground and got everybody looking right at these little trees that were planted in the spring, and I showed them how tree planting depth is so critical to the success of the trees and kind of help people learn in really, really practical things about if you're going to plant trees, here's how to plant them correctly.
What kind of trees is Bruce planting? Because he used to have row crops, didn't he?
Yeah, so Bruce converted his row crop farm to pasture and decided to sell beef instead of corn and soybeans, mostly to community members around him. people in Des Moines and Ames and in his neighborhood. And then the next level, kind of as he entered retirement recently, he's thinking a lot about legacy, thinking a lot about what does it all mean, you know, and how can I make this land even better for my children and grandchildren. And he's realized that he's kind of tapped out his productive potential just with grass, you know, grass and legumes in the pastures. And he would love to add even more productive potential to his land by growing stuff above the grass, trees. He's had a lot of experiments over time. He's planted a few windbreaks to try to shelter the animals from wind and snow, you know. He's planted some forest in areas that were really sensitive to grazing, you know, places along streams where they flood, you know, and it's just too hard to protect the water quality, you know, if there's animals standing in there. But the next level is he is planting tree crops. So he's planting, like, stuff you can pick up off the ground, nuts, you know, that you can grow and sell. He's planting northern pecans, hazelnuts, black walnuts, hard maples, so he can tap maple trees in 20 years, or his children can. And then the next level is he's going to plant all sorts of interesting trees that can be used for fodder, so you can, like, cut the branches off and feed the leaves to the animals. So those species of trees would be, like, cottonwood or willow, maybe honey locust, you know, stuff that's really sugary sweet. And what's really cool about that is you can just prune off the branches and the tree will grow back. So he can literally, like, harvest food from his trees and then they'll regenerate.
Wow, that sounds exciting. Now, how long will it take the nut trees to start producing?
Most trees don't start making a seed until maybe year 5 to 7. You know, they take a while to get their roots established. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, you know, it's a crop that maybe takes 6 to 7 years to get the first nuts from, and then maybe typical yield or maximum yield wouldn't probably start until years 12 and 15.
And is there a pretty good market? I suppose you'll have to wait for 7 or 8 years to find out.
Yeah, there's really strong market for fresh local food, as we all see from our many successful farmers markets and other community local food buying options out there. But yeah, nuts in particular, like, let's say you didn't want to tap in any of those local markets, there's quite a lot of demand from ethnic communities throughout the country for chestnuts in particular. So there's actually you know, people that would send a truck to your farm and take a whole semi-load if you had them.
Wow.
And you wouldn't even have to market them locally. You could just get rid of them for, you know, for more of a wholesale price. I think the biggest challenge with chestnuts is just making sure you have the labor available to pick them up off the ground, because they have to be picked up every day. That they kind of fall from the tree over a period of 2 or 3 weeks. So, you know, maybe that's migrant labor you bring in, like apple harvest. Maybe you do a U-pick, so you invite people to come to your farm to pick up the nuts. So, yeah, I think there's lots of options. It just takes someone with a creative spirit to go for it.
So how's Bruce working that with his cattle? Do they have the trees all fenced off, or?
Yeah, he's got a single hot wire on either side, and that kind of keeps the animals from getting too close to the trees. So he'll probably exclude animals from within 20 feet of the trees for at least the first 5 years, and then after that, maybe just flash them through for, you know, a couple days at a time, maybe twice a year. And then when the nuts start to fall, there's probably a harvest restriction where you can't have any animals underneath the trees for like 120 days before harvest. So maybe just in the early spring, mm-hmm. you could utilize some of that forage. But the value of those nuts is going to be so much more valuable than the forage. You know, I mean, a potential acre of chestnuts could earn $10,000 profit a year after it's established.
Well, that's pretty good.
We did a story on chestnuts a few years ago, and one of the things I know is that they're incredibly labor intensive. Do they take that into account when they're planting them?
Bruce's chestnuts at this stage are a very small amount, you know, relative to maybe a commercial farm. So it's mostly just for his local meat customers, I'd say, to come enjoy, and his family to share. But yeah, if you were going to plant two or three acres of chestnuts and get like a 10 or 15 acre farm of chestnuts, you would have to have that in your labor management plan, like who's going to manage the trees, you know, when are we going to bring in the labor, even with paid labor. High quality chestnuts are a pretty lucrative crop, you know, and so it's a neat option for people.
I was kind of curious, but why should it be so difficult? And it's the harvesting, because they're extremely prickly and worse than black walnuts, right?
Yeah, you'd have to wait until the nuts open up from their prickly shell and they fall on the ground. So, yeah, it's you wouldn't want to have to put the leather gloves on and pick through the spikes to get the nuts out, that's for sure. You want to just let them fall to the ground and then pick them up with a rolling nut wizard, they call them.
Okay, so they're mechanizing even that. That's good to know.
Chestnuts are a really interesting crop and something that I think a lot of people could benefit from adding to their farm.
So in 7 to 10 years, what would a tree produce in pounds?
Yeah, good question. It really depends on the amount of moisture in August during the nut fill period, but I'd say potentially thousands of pounds of nuts per acre. Maybe we don't even know yet what the full yield potential is, because there's not a lot of chestnut farms in Iowa. You know, they're still establishing. And so, yeah, I think that I've heard as much as like 8 to 10,000 pounds of nuts an acre, if, you know, if they're really well irrigated or we have really, you know, seasonally timely rain.
How about just one tree?
One tree, yeah. Okay, so I would say maybe a pickup load of nuts per tree.
Oh, okay.
One of the things that we learned from the Australian visitor was that the trees were important in bringing water into the soil.
Oh, yeah.
And since we're predicted to have drier summers, I wonder if this is at all factored into the advantage of having more trees.
Absolutely. I mean, when you add any sort of diversity to your farm, any sort of new species, every species has different root architecture. You know, they have different depths of roots and different kinds of effects on how percolation and infiltration of water through the soil occurs. Plus, there's a lot more uptake. So when you have a tree with all these leaves out, you know, those solar collectors are pumping out moisture all the time, right? As part of the process of photosynthesis, you know, there's so much heat produced in that process. But one way to dissipate that energy is to use water to kind of cool the process down, you know. And so think about that. Like there's infiltration that increases with trees. There's increased uptake of water due to the photosynthetic process. Just capturing the water before it hits the ground. Like if it hits a tree first, that water, that energy of the rain is actually going to be less damaging to your soil, so you could potentially benefit from that as well. So yeah, I think there's numerous ways that trees could benefit us through this climate change future we're going to be experiencing.
Well, I'm also wondering about crops. Of course, we now know about shade-grown coffee, and that this is a crop that benefits from being grown under trees. Mm-hmm. Are there any food crops that we could grow in Iowa that would grow in the shade?
Yeah, well, the first one that's on my mind is beef. Let's keep it simple, you know, for the first generation. Beef loves a little bit of shade. You know, Bruce was saying that his weaned cattle are like 50 pounds heavier when they come out of a shaded pasture than ones that are open grown in sun. So if you can put 50 more pounds of weight on an animal just by reducing their stress from the sun, you know, and increasing the quality of their forage, cool season pastures tend to produce, I think, 20% more forage throughout the year if they're shade-grown, partially shade-grown. So, yeah, I think there's, you know, no need to reinvent the wheel on some of this stuff. I think just better understanding and helping people to truly believe the science that's already out there about the positive effect of trees is critical.
When you're talking to property owners or farmers about silvopasture or agroforestry, what are you? What are some of the costs and benefits?
Great question. I think the biggest hurdle is people's fear of being different. And I think you see this in town. You know, there's so many different things we could be doing in people's turf. You know, like lawn is one of the most expensive ways to manage land. It's got the least amount of wildlife benefit, pollinator benefit. But what do people put on their front yards? Turf, you know, because there's this fear of being different, fear you're going to lose value of your property if you have it look messy, you know. So I think farmers are no different than homeowners in town. The other big hurdle, so that's, I guess, one of the drawbacks, is you have to be willing to be different and try something new. The other cost and benefits would be time. Most landowners in Iowa are fairly old, and they're concerned that the money they invest might not be realized as a profit in their lifetime. And they also have to think about the next generation. Bruce, for example, knows that his family will be the next owner of the land. If you are not sure who's going to own the land in 10, 15, 20 years, you may be more hesitant to invest in long-term benefits to your land. Initial cost of learning something new is pretty high. You know, like you'd have to either pay me to help educate you, or you'd have to spend a lot of time reading up on new opportunities, going to field days. So I think education is still a big barrier. I think the complexity of soil and systems, I think the complexity of nature is intimidating and a huge drawback for people. We've had generations of kind of a command and control, simplified land management approach, and there's many benefits of that. Number one, you just don't have to think as much, and you can enjoy your life. You don't have to struggle and try new things, and whenever you want to add more complexity to your farm or land management, you have to be open to learning and having some things maybe not work out the way you thought, just because that's what happens when you do something new. Whenever I plant trees, I always plant 6 to 12 species because I just don't know which one of them are going to really do that well in that spot, you know?
And yes, I can understand that.
Oh, thank you so much. And that's a great closing line. We have a wonderful song from Water Rocks.
Perfect.
Trees short, trees tall. So thank you so much for being with us today, Luke. That was Luke Rand.
My pleasure.
KHOI has been trying to get interviews with as many political candidates as possible. Every 4 years, we grow a very healthy crop of political candidates to watch. That's why we're grateful to have another political reporter joining us for this intense time. Her name is Lily Bolke, and she is employed by Pacifica Network and Public News Service. But because she's working out of our studio, we can run some of the interviews she gathers. Her first was last Saturday at a meet and greet for Tim Ryan. As some of you may know, Ryan dropped out of the race the day after her interview on Sunday. But I'm excited about playing that interview anyway, because Lily asks some very thought-provoking questions. We often say that we want candidates to listen to us and answer what they hear. Here's what it sounds like when somebody does.
I'm curious about sort of, you talked a lot about the regenerative and sustainable agriculture, and I was just wondering what kind of traction that's getting in Iowa so far, especially in western Iowa where there's a lot of big agriculture and big farms.
More and more. A lot of farmers are in the old system. They get crop insurance and, you know, they're kind of in on that. But there's an opening now, and people are looking for something different because they haven't made a profit in 5 years. The tariff issue has got them looking. And so what I'm hearing from the regenerative ag community is that there are people coming out of the woodwork now saying, now tell me again what you're doing. Like, why are you making a profit? Plant in April, and I had to wait till June to plant. Like, what are you doing differently with your soil? And so these questions are being asked, and I think it's a real opening for us to go in with a progressive message about a new way of doing things that are going to help the farmers. And we're not going to ignore them, and they're going to make money off of when we're in office.
So what was your reaction to this group in here, especially some of the kids and being involved in politics and, you know, being really interested? What were your thoughts about that?
Well, it was really interesting. We had one kid who talked about sleep. And we had another kid talk about anxiety and stress. And what's interesting about these kids who are 10, 11 years old, 12 years old, is that they say what's on their minds. And the other two kids asked about the CAFOs, and one asked about plastics in the water. So they talked about their health and how they feel about things. And they talked about the health of the planet. I thought that was really interesting, as that's their view. It's just amazing. And I think that's really, they were talking about some of the key issues, right? How do we handle what we're doing to the environment, and that they instinctively see and are concerned about, and how do we take care of them? You know, they're really, my wife's a first grade teacher. You know, I used to coach, and we just have always been around kids, and 16-year-old, 15-year-old, and Brady's 5. So we're very concerned about the world that these kids are growing up in, the challenges, the stress, the technology, the seeing things that I didn't see until I was in college, hearing things because of the information that's so accessible today. Mm-hmm. And we've got to really focus on how we take care of them and how we help them deal with conflict, how we help them build resiliency, how we teach them how to regulate their own emotional state, how we teach them how to deal with conflict. Like, these are things that need to be intentional in our approach to educating kids, not something that we hope society teaches them, because society's different now. You know, you're not in a one-room schoolhouse anymore. You have access to all kinds of information that, quite frankly, we don't really want them to have access to, but they do anyway. And so, okay, how do we live in that world and help them? And that's why I've been really focused on my K-12 proposal around social and emotional learning and trauma-informed curriculum and making sure they have access to mental health therapists if they need it, art therapy, music therapy, play therapy. I really want to get at the trauma that these kids are dealing with. And for an 11-year-old girl to ask you about anxiety, I didn't even think of that when I was her age. You know, maybe I should have been, but I wasn't. And they are now, and we should be there to help them.
And, I mean, they seem to really stay interested and want to have a conversation with you. What do you think it is about you and how you were presenting yourself and approaching these people that allowed them to really be interested like that?
I try to be open and engaging the best I can and relaxed so that people relax and then we can have a real conversation. And I think this election is not going to be about lectures by politicians. It's going to be about a conversation that we're going to have around new ideas. And I think it's interesting. I just throw out my ideas around all these different issues around food and health and education and the economy, and people start thinking. They say, well, I have an idea. Some guy walked up to me at the bar with, gave me a big piece of paper about an idea he has about renewable energy. So I hope to cultivate that in the country, that this is a country of ideas, that if we're going to get out of this mess, it's going to be through our imagination, not just data. Like, we all know what needs to be done. Like, one new data point is not going to shift America. The imagination is what's going to shift America, and that's what I hope to do.
Yeah. And you talked a little bit with that last question, and just in general about sort of, let's not call it left or right, let's sort of focus on better. And just, and I saw somewhere your, like some bumper stickers with the slogan, like, you don't have to yell. And so I was just wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about that, and what are your thoughts on sort of the idea of, you know, civility in politics and discourse?
Yeah, that was just a little poking some fun with Bernie from the debate the other night. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think everyone's just tired of, we're exhausted. You know, we're all exhausted by the political discourse today of the right and what tribe do you belong to? What team are you on? Or is it blue or red? And it's just, the whole thing's freaking exhausting. And so I'm trying to create an environment where we're talking about new and better and in proposing issues where Democrats and Republicans can both get behind so that we can actually move forward. And like, think about it. This conversation has been going on since Vietnam and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, and just divide, 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 and culture wars and culture wars and culture wars. Like, please stop. Everybody just stop. Let's hit the reset button. And that's why I like the new ideas I'm presenting are new. They're very progressive. They're transformational, and they have bipartisan support. That's the way we need to go.
What was sort of the moment that you decided that you were going to run for president?
I just feel like my experiences in a place like Northeast Ohio and old industrial towns have really given me the experience of figuring it out for local communities around the future of work. What are the jobs going to be? The future of education? How do we deal with the trauma our kids are dealing with? We have an opiate addiction. We have schools that are underfunded. We have crime. We have, you know, I'm in the foxhole with the American people and have been my whole life. This is where I grew up. How do we get healthier? And so over my life and my career, I got into Congress when I was 29. I've really been immersed in not just the problems, but the solutions. And I just feel like right now it's really time for those new solutions. And I want to offer that up and see what the American people think about it. But we're offering something very, very different that is doable. I mean, what we heard on the debate stage this week is it's not doable. It's just, it's continuing the left-right conversation that's going to get us absolutely nowhere. I mean, there's not 60 votes for these proposals. I mean, we're going to go to workers and tell them, you know, we're going to give free health care to undocumented people in the country when they can't even make ends meet and they can't even pay for their own health care, and veterans aren't getting the health care that they need. I don't even know why we're having that conversation. Like, again, I'm a humanitarian. You know, obviously, undocumented people in the country should be able to pay for health care. We shouldn't box them out. Taking people's health insurance away, like, that's a recipe for disaster for us. And the goal for me is, how do we beat Donald Trump? You want a revolution? That's the revolution we want, to start new. And so having things that are really achievable, bold, achievable, and a break with the past are really what I'm going for.
You kind of started off talking about labor. And talking about, you know, unions and things like that. So I was just sort of wondering if you could...
I have a very strong labor record. I have my whole years in Congress. My grandfather was a steel worker. My grandmother was in AFSCME. My mom was in AFSCME. All my cousins were construction trade, plumbers, pipe fitters, you know, electricians, a lot of steel workers, auto workers. And I feel like they've been forgotten. You know, they are really an afterthought. I mean, in Detroit, I was the only one really talking about unions. And I just feel like we're not talking about the main problem in the country, which is workers' wages are down and have, you know, they tick up in the last, you know, 6 months to a year, they tick up 0.2%. And, you know, the president's running around like like the problem of inequality has been solved. And, you know, we talk about, as I said, I think we talk a lot about the band-aids that have to go on the systems that are broken, as opposed to transforming the economic system where we're actually creating jobs that are 30, 40, 50 bucks an hour so that people can pay for their child care.
Yeah.
Right, they can pay for their help their kids go to college or save for college or save for retirement or have a union job where they negotiate a good pension. That's the main issue. And we're having the whole conversation now is really around the Band-Aids. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm for some of the Band-Aids because we need to do them because the economy isn't working. But the goal should be, how do we move into the next 10 years really creating jobs that pay for people?
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And I couldn't help noticing with our last speaker that the local soundtrack of Ames and Central Iowa, the passing railroad train, was in the background. Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, have been your host for today. Other voices you heard were Beanne Sandy, Tony Sorensen, Jerry White, Pat Smith, Jerry Hatfield, Lily Balky, Luke Gran, and Tim Ryan.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. And if you like us on Facebook, you can get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was In the Good Old Summertime, Barbershop Quartet, Trees Short, Trees Tall by Water Rocks, and Birthday by the Beatles.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership. Just look for the yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and see you again on the radio.